A new round of talks is underway in Vienna between Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal. Tehran is seeking a full and verifiable removal of sanctions. Russia warning it will respond to security threats from NATO and Ukraine if necessary. Also in the headlines, tens of thousands of Sudanese take to the streets in the capital Khartoum to protest against last month's military coup d'etat. This is World News. I'm our Tehran studios with me, your host, Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. A fresh round of talks in Vienna between Iran, the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal, is in its second day. Tehran saying it will settle for nothing less than the removal of sanctions. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman says Tehran will also give no commitments beyond the provisions in the 2015 deal. Said Khatibzadeh stressed that issues such as step-by-step negotiations or new commitments have no place in this round. He said that the Iranian government has joined the talks with a fully prepared delegation in serious resolve to ensure the sanctions will be removed. Khatibzadeh noted that the talks will move on the right track if the opposite side takes part with good intention and avoids wasting time or making childish excuses. Iran and the P4 plus 1 began the talks on Monday after nearly a six-month hiatus. Okay, from Vienna, let's bring in Huma Liski. Huma, what's the latest?
Yes, Behrouz, as you said there, this is the second day of the Vienna talks, the resumption of these talks, more than 5 months after the pause that we saw following the new Iranian administration coming into office. We just, ahead of our live, got information that Mr. Bagheri, the head of Iran's delegation here, has had a meeting, and I assume still is in a meeting if it's not over yet. We still don't know the details, with Enrique Mora, the EU coordinator. So these meetings are ongoing. At the same time, today, as you said earlier, the working group at the expert level has started its work on sanctions removal, and we heard that on Wednesday, tomorrow, the second working group focusing on nuclear commitments, meaning the measures that Iran needs to take to come back to full compliance, will also start its work. At the same time, diplomatic efforts are ongoing, although the experts or the technical experts here who are in these delegations are involved in these the nitty-gritty. The political directors are also involved in separate meetings together, expressing, of course, their own views, exchanging opinions. We know that the United States delegation is indirectly involved in the talks, since it's not a party to the JCPOA. It's not in the Joint Commission session, but the delegations are meeting separately with the Russians, the Chinese, the Europeans, and Mr. Enrique Mora, the EU coordinator, and their positions are then conveyed to the Iranians. The Iranian positions are conveyed to the other sides, etc. So these expert-level talks are going to continue. Well, we still don't know when the next Joint Commission session will be held. I think it depends on how these talks are going to progress from this stage on, maybe by the end of this week, probably, if not later, we might see the end of the seventh round of talks. We will then have a wrap-up meeting of the Joint Commission. The sides will express their positions about the process of this seventh round and then decide when they need to come back and where. So that's the process that we're in right now. As to, of course, the situation we're facing, it is indeed a very complex issue. Although Mr. Mora, yesterday, after he came out of the Joint Commission session, said that he was positive and that he saw that there was serious will both on the Iranian side and on the side of the Westerners, the Europeans and the US. This still doesn't mean, according to a lot of political observers, that it's going to be an easy process, or even that they can say they're optimistic about success. We still don't know how willing the United States is to remove all of the sanctions, including those imposed additionally under Trump. which up until now the U.S. has said it does not consider JCPOA related, but Iran says that they are, because although some of these sanctions have been imposed under different labels, they are in effect influencing the implementation of the JCPOA and affecting Iran's economic benefits from this deal. So that's one thing. And also there's the issue of timing. Iran saying that it wants the U.S. to take the first step and that they're not going to back down on this issue because they believe, in the words of Mr. Barghari, that the U.S. should pay the price and face the consequences for being the party that withdrew from the agreement in the first place and created this crisis initially. Mr. Barghari himself, the head of the Iranian team, just ahead of the talks, wrote an extensive column that was published ahead of the Vienna talks. And I think anyone who wants to get an idea of what the positions of the Iranian team are will benefit from reading that piece by him, in which he outlines the principles that Iran is going to stay steadfast on and is not going to budge on. And that includes getting guarantees from the Americans, he said, when it comes to both imposing additional sanctions, imposing new sanctions, or in his words, using the JCPOA as a tool to increase pressure on Iran, even in areas that are not nuclear related. With this position that's been expressed by the Iranian team, we'll have to see if the political will exists on the side of the Europeans and the Americans to go back to full compliance.
Okay, we'll wait and see what's going to happen next. Thank you very much for that, Omar Lesger, correspondent in Vienna. Now, we've also talked to Professor Mohammad Mirandi, who is with the Iranian delegation in the Austrian capital, and he explains that Iran has never breached a 2015 nuclear deal, while the U.S. has been violating it from the very first day after signing it.
I think by now everyone knows that with regards to the nuclear deal, the side that kept its promises was Iran. And the United States, from day one, when they signed the deal in this city, in Vienna, they violated the deal. Under Biden, they're violating the deal. Under Trump, they violated the deal. And under Obama, they violated the deal. The United States tore up the agreement, and even after they tore up the agreement, the Iranians continued to abide by their commitments in full for a whole year. And then only gradually did they decrease their commitments within the framework of the nuclear deal. In other words, Articles 26 and 36 allow Iran to decrease or end their commitments if the other side fails to abide by their commitments. So Iran never in the past nor now has it been violating the deal. The other side now, if they want to re-engage with Iran, if they want Iran to abide by its commitments, the least that they can do is to put aside all sanctions and go back to 2015, let alone the fact that the Iranians have serious issues with regards to compensation and verification.
Time now for the news review. Now, Russia-NATO tensions heating up with both sides engaging in a war of words, once again over Ukraine. The Russian president warning that the Western military alliance against expanding its military infrastructure in Ukraine. Vladimir Putin calls it a red line and says that he hopes the alliance won't cross it. Putin also voiced concern over war games held near his country's borders. The Russian foreign minister has also accused NATO of deploying a significant amount of military hardware near Russian borders. Sergei Lavrov says that Moscow will respond to security threats from Western countries and Ukraine if necessary. Meantime, NATO chief has warned Russia that it will pay a, quote, high price if it uses force against Ukraine. Moscow has repeatedly dismissed claims that Russia is preparing to invade Ukraine. It says the military buildup is in response to growing NATO activities on its borders. Now, let me invite a couple of guests and see what they think about this story. So Mike Harris, editor of the Veterans Today, is joining me from Phoenix. Also Sarah Flounders, international with the International Action Center out of New York. Welcome to you both. Now, Mike, who's a threat in Europe? I mean, because NATO is blaming Russia. Russia is saying, I'm not going to invade Ukraine. And we have this, you know, movements along the borders because NATO is also bringing its forces close to Russian borders. So who's doing what? What's happening?
Well, let's point out a couple things. First of all, that Russia is not former Soviet Union. That's primary. So NATO really has no reason to exist. NATO has continued to expand its presence eastward in spite of the promises that were made when the Berlin Wall came down and all that peace process took place, the reunification of Germany, all of these things. NATO has continued to press eastward again and again and again. Secondly, let's remember that Kiev is the historical capital of Russia, and so there is a very legitimate Russian claim to that territory, to that land, those people. They're primarily Russian speakers. NATO needs a war. They don't have any justification for why they exist anymore, because once NATO was formed to stop the Soviet Union from expanding, once the Soviet Union ceased to exist, there is no need for NATO to exist. So NATO has, as like all bureaucracies, it hangs on. Nobody wants to cut their paycheck. Nobody wants to end their career. And right now the West, because of the financial difficulties and the other social issues that are going on in the entire Western civilization, the U.S., Europe, all of it, they need a war. They need a war to obfuscate the malmanagement of the current regimes and how they've mismanaged our financial system, how they've impoverished our people, how they've offloaded all of our industrial and technological industries into China. The West is teetering on collapse, and they want a war to cover it up. So that's really what the situation is, as far as I can see. As far as I can see it, this is firmly in NATO's backyard as the aggressor, the ones who are pushing eastward. Russia hasn't done this. If they wanted to expand into Ukraine, they could have done that long ago.
Okay. Sarah, how do you look at the situation?
Well, I very much agree that NATO exists in complete violation of the agreement in 1990 that NATO would not expand one inch into the former Soviet areas and into East Europe. And of course they did. They expanded right to the very borders of Russia. This is an aggressive U.S. commanded nuclear armed military alliance. And NATO exists to make super profits for U.S. military industries. That has absolutely continued as a gravy train nonstop. And the military industries in the U.S. are dominant, are the greatest source of profit. It's a very dangerous moment because the expansion of NATO, just consider this summer, naval NATO war drills in the Black Sea. Every step of this has been aggressive and has been moving more and more missiles and weapons directly around Russia. Russia has not moved one inch, but they have said that they would protect and defend their own country. Right. And they see the NATO expansion into the Ukraine, which is now a stated goal and has been all along, right, since the U.S. engineered an absolute coup against the elected government in 2014 and brought in their own group of complete cronies into the government of the Ukraine. This was really, we got to call it a coup d'etat for the expansion of NATO. Russia stood up to that in the Crimea, and they have drawn a line. As Putin says, this is a red line.
Okay, appreciate your comments and insight. Mike Harris, editor of the Veterans Today in Phoenix. Sarah Flanders with International Action Center in New York. Welcome back. Tens of thousands of Sudanese have again hit the streets to denounce last month's military takeover and a recent deal that saw Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok reinstated after his ouster in the coup. In capital Khartoum, security forces used tear gas to disperse protesters who were marching on the presidential palace. They chanted slogans urging the military to go back to their barracks. Similar events were held in other cities. Last month, the military seized power, detaining Hamdok and several members of his cabinet despite a 2019 power-sharing deal with civilian leaders. The military reinstated the premier in the deal they signed last week. Pro-democracy activists are opposed to any deal with the military, citing the deadly crackdown on protests. More than 40 rallyers have been killed since the October 25th coup. Now, Barbados is celebrating a watershed moment in its history, formally ending the rule of the British monarchy.
With firm resolve and in one voice, from this day and forever, declare Barbados a parliamentary republic.
Now, with Sandra Mason inaugurated as president, the Caribbean island is now the world's newest republic, and that means it's finally removed Britain's Queen Elizabeth as its head of state after almost four centuries. Hundreds of people gathered in the capital of Bridgetown to celebrate. Barbados will remain a republic within the Commonwealth, a grouping of 54 countries across Africa, Asia, the Americas, and Europe. Experts believe that the move could encourage other Commonwealth nations to consider breaking away from the British monarchy. A London correspondent assures us that many in Barbados want an apology and reparations from the British monarchy for its colonial era inhumane slave trade.
Then there is the issue of reparations that Barbados has talked about for many years, but whether or not now is the time to do it is another matter. They're saying it's not really about money, but it's about justice and an apology from the monarchy, perhaps, for whatever that's happened over the course of centuries the island of nation of Barbados, a country of now nearly 300,000 people. We heard the Queen's son, the heir to the throne, Prince Charles, saying things such as the atrocity of slavery, that it will forever tarnish our history. But whether or not that is enough, words will really be enough for the Barbadians is really something we'll have to wait and see.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you might remember, we talked about Imam Khomeini's recommendations on supporting the oppressed and fighting the oppressors, especially the global arrogance and Zionism. We will continue the discussion in this episode. Stay tuned, please. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, in his testament stresses that one of the main problems of the Islamic countries and oppressed nations are the mercenary regimes of these countries. He believes that these regimes try to keep these nations weak, backward, and dependent. He writes, "At least for the recent 100 years, that the big world-devouring powers gradually put their steps in the Islamic countries and other small countries, we have witnessed or have been told by correct histories that none of the ruling governments in these countries have thought of their nation's freedom, independence, and welfare. Almost all of them have rather been engaged in oppression and suffocation of their nation or have only tried for their vested or group interest, or for the welfare of the wealthy and upper class, and the oppressed slum habiting classes have been denied all life blessings such as water and bread, and those miserable have been employed for the interest of the wealthy and debauchee stratum, or they have been the puppets of big powers, which have employed whatever they can to make countries and nations dependent and have made countries the markets of the East and the West through different tricks and have secured their interest and have raised nations backward and consumers, and they are moving with the same plan." Imam Khomeini writes in his testament, "The misery for Muslims are the governments that are dependent on the East and the West, and I emphatically recommend you not to listen to the propaganda horns of the opponents of Islam and the Islamic Republic, which all try to expel Islam from the scene so that the interests of the superpowers are secured." Imam Khomeini also writes, "O you, the oppressed of the world, and you, the Islamic countries and Muslims of the world, stand up and grasp the right with hands and teeth, and do not be scared of the propaganda ballyhoo of superpowers and their servile stooges, and expel from your countries the criminal rulers who submit your efforts to your enemies. And expel from your countries the criminal rulers who submit your efforts to your enemies. And you and the committed serving classes take the helms of affairs and gather together under the flag of Islam to rise up for defense against the enemies of Islam and the deprived of the world. Imam Khomeini believed that confronting the media hype of the oppressive powers is the main duty of Muslims. He writes, "Today and in the future, what must be important for the Iranian nation and the Muslims of the world is the foiling of the disuniting and destructive propaganda." Elsewhere in his testament, the Imam writes, "I recommend Muslims, particularly the Iranians in the current era, to show reaction against conspiracies, increase their solidarity and unity in any possible way, and disappoint the disbelievers and the hypocrites." Imam Khomeini says, "The prominent ulema and respectable preachers of the Islamic countries should invite governments to free themselves of dependence of big powers and come to mutual understanding with their nation, as, in this way, they will embrace victory. And let them invite nations to unity and refrain from racism, which is opposite to Islam. And let them shake the hands of fraternity with their brothers in faith in any country and from any race, because the great Islam has called them brothers. And if this brotherhood in faith materializes through the efforts of governments and nations with the help of Almighty God, you will see that Muslims will form the greatest power in the world, with the hope of the day on which, God willing, this fraternity and equality will materialize." Imam Khomeini also writes, "I recommend the Islamic nations to take the role model of the Islamic Republic government and the Iranian struggling nation to put the oppressive governments in their place. If they do not capitulate to the will of their nations, the source of misery of Muslims are the governments that are dependent on the East and the West."
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
simple question.
British sport is once again under fire, and for an all-too-familiar problem, racism. This time the story flared up in English cricket when one Yorkshire cricketer, Azeem Rafiq, revealed to a parliamentary committee that in his experience racism, without a shadow of a doubt, was widespread. He also claimed that, instead of facing up to the need to deal with it, abuse from his colleagues was not tackled and instead treated as a joke or friendly banter.
Giving evidence to the Parliamentary Digital Culture, Media and Sport Select Committee, Azeem Rafiq stated English cricket is institutionally racist. He recounted the inhuman treatment he endured after his son was still born in 2017. Also, according to Rafiq, in cricket, racist language was used constantly, never stamped out, and the norm, and people didn't think it was wrong. Similar issues have also been reported in English football, with visibly ethnic players repeatedly enduring abuse from the terrace and from other players. The impact has been relentless and corrosive. In Azeem Rafiq's case, he believes he lost his career to the effects of racism over a prolonged period. However, former footballer John Barnes, who echoes the concerns and revelations of Azeem Rafiq, does not think the impact of such revelations will be an end to the issue. He believes institutions will just scapegoat people and think we're making a change by increasing ethnic representation in sport.
Why, after all these years, do racism and other forms of ethnic abuse appear to remain endemic in British sport? And what message does it send out to fans who watch from the terrace and see this sort of behaviour on the pitch? Simple questions with important answers. And let's start with this. To what extent should sports people in the United Kingdom feel able to compete completely free of any form of racial abuse? We put that question to the public here outside London's iconic cricket ground, the Oval. Here's what they said.
Anyway, that's another story. Let me just ask you the questions. Ready?
Okay. So there's no test of knowledge. I'm just going to fire a couple of questions and see what you think.
You're welcome.
We're here at Oval today, and we're here today at the Oval, and we're asking the public...
The recent allegations of racism in sport.
Sorry.
First question. To what extent should sports people in Britain be able to compete without racist abuse?
Yeah, of course there shouldn't be no racism at all.
I mean, it sounds extremely unfair that for so many they do end up going to play and just get heckled and their focus is drawn away from the sport that they're playing and suddenly their identity is being attacked.
Well, there's no racism, there's no discrimination of any kind, everybody just kind of gets brought together. That's what I love about sport.
Well, of course, you shouldn't have to worry about anything like that. You know, sport is sport. There shouldn't have to... Any of those sort of issues shouldn't come anywhere near the sport, you know.
To what extent do you think that British sports people should be able to do their sport without any fear of racism or religious discrimination?
Oh, 100%.
Why?
Well, because it's not relevant to the sport that they're playing.
I know nothing about cricket, but what I know is that it's completely international. It's all over the world. So that's beautiful. It's something that should bring people together, not apart.
Yeah, of course. Like, I think races and all this stuff, it's been, like, you know, for ages.
It's a great shame. It's something that's an ongoing battle by all accounts.
I'm from abroad. I can't imagine there's racism in British sports.
I believe racism is inborn.
Yes.
It's not avoidable easily.
Do you think that British sports people should be able to compete without fear of racist abuse?
I do. Unfortunately, it's very rife and has been for a very, very long time.
They said something on the news this morning. There's this whole thing about people excuse racism by saying it's banter. And this whole thing about bants that has suddenly become a byword for I can get away with saying anything. Oh, it's just bants, which it's not.
In reality, there is still racism ongoing. We know that is true. There's racism ongoing.
In the honesty of all of it, there shouldn't be any fear of it. I think we've come a long way. Like, British history in regards to colonialism has come apart a long, long, long way. 21st century, there shouldn't be any fear.
To be honest, I don't think any racism I observed. Absolutely. Yeah. It isn't just racist abuse. It's about sexist abuse. It's about inclusion. Everyone should be able to get to the best that they can possibly be.
People should be able to freely participate in any sport.
How does the public feel about cricketer Azim Rafiq and footballers claiming that British sport is institutionally racist?
Institutionalised? I'm not really sure. I wouldn't be able to give a definite opinion on that, but I mean, I can understand that there might be some elements to suggest that.
I think we've been letting it go on for too long, and in that sense it is institutionalised, it's part of the system.
In my standard and in my understanding, it was so exaggerated, and I disagree with you.
I couldn't tell you much about it, to be fair, Paul, but I did see a little bit, and if as the case obviously needs to get stamped out.
Everyone that is racist or thinks racism should belong somewhere, wherever it might be, should not exist, in my opinion. Like, honestly, just change your mind. It's not a thing. It's 2021. Get over it.
That's kind of disappointing because we're at, like, 2021, so we'll be like, we should be able to do whatever we want.
It's sad. You know, the fact is that we try to combat so many different elements, but it's still there.
There's one expression here in English language saying this is not cricket. So this means to me cricket is a very, very fair sport, and it's to be open-minded to everybody.
Racism is not a good feeling. The outcome is horrible. People should really accept everyone.
I've lived in this country for about 40-something years. My family live in Australia. And I've always gone on about, in Australia, the racism, the sexism, the homophobia was always in your face. So you knew it was there and you could deal with it. In this country, there's a whole veneer of politeness. I didn't realize how misogynist men were in this country. It took me about 10, 15 years to work it out. And if I think that's the same thing, I think that's probably the same with racism.
I'm not surprised to hear about that because I know that racism is many places in this country. It's practicable many places, both secretly and openly. We know of that.
I wouldn't be surprised if it was institutionally racist, but I think it's got opportunity to grow. You know, he would know more about it because he's in the field. But yeah.
It makes me feel sad, but at the same time, it's just the reality. I mean, the British, the UK is quite institutionally racist.
I think it's been acknowledged that there is a massive problem that needs to be addressed. It may be not just in our sport, it might be across the culture of the country, but we're definitely going to deal with it.
Why is there still so much racism in British sport, is the public's opinion.
Just because England has got such kind of deep tradition, deep culture, especially with kind of like the British Empire colonialism only ending about, what, like 50 years ago.
I wish I knew. I mean, it's a terrible, terrible thing. I know, I'm lucky I don't experience anything like that myself, but I imagine it's terrible.
I don't know why. It could be jealousy. They earn plenty of money.
I think there was just an unawareness of, you know, what multiculturalism actually meant.
I couldn't tell you the reason why. I don't think it's sport-specific, but I think, obviously, with the emotions of sport, it comes out a little bit more. But either way, it's got no place.
Because sport is just, you know, a microcosm of of society.
To be honest, I think it's always been there. It's just like now we have more voice to say. Like before, as you say, we've been like a lot of people, a majority has been living with fear. And now we know, like, we are actually 2021 and we be able to express ourselves.
Because I think it's something that is institutionalised. Unfortunately, that goes back many, many years.
When people are good, people have reason to pick on them. If people can't be like you, they want to antagonize you. As simple as that.
I think it's always been there and always will be. Hidden under the carpet, brushed under the carpet, whatever you call it. But I think it will always be anti-this, anti-that.
It's something of mine, because I know black people have contributed a lot to this country. You see, when black people do things good, they will say they are British. But when they commit crime, then they will say they are Nigerians or they are Afghanistanian or they are from Ghana.
I think the irony is fair, like, and that's the irony to the first question you asked, if there should be any fear around it. I think all racism comes from just fear, it's just ignorance.
I think, British people, they are very sporting, very sporting-oriented people. And I rate that is oil from my side.
They have this imperialist domination of the world that they show in the news and everywhere, and so that they think that also, you know, they are entitled to discriminate other because their country discriminate other countries.
I think it's culture. I think the difficulty is culture, is that maybe that communities aren't encouraged to mix and understand each other.
Research by the Professional Cricketers Association revealed 25% had witnessed or experienced racism. Among ethnic cricketers, that figure rose to over 58%. 45% said it came from another player, with 39% saying it came from fans or on social media. 62% said it was disguised as banter. In football, using pre-COVID data, reports of racism rose by 43% between 2018 and 2019, with faith-based discrimination, including Islamophobia, going up by 75%, more than any other form of abuse. Over 70% of fans across England now think professional football in the country has a serious problem with racism. We asked the public, what impact does racism on the pitch have on racism in the audience?
I think that professional players in any sport, cricket, football, anything, they need to be role models, they need to be better, because they need to understand that their behaviour on the pitch is going to be emanated by thousands, by millions, potentially, of fans.
I think it's completely dependent on the fan. I mean, if the fan is anti-racism, it's devastating. If they are a racist, suddenly their minds, their way of thinking is actually being backed up, and they're suddenly believing it to be acceptable.
The fans, they are not the very educated people, or there's so many different mixed group. Yeah, some of them maybe they are idiot or they say some things, but we cannot accuse whole country because of some idiot in the fans. We cannot say that. Yeah, it could be.
Do fans take their lead from players, what they see on the pitch? Is that, you know, there's an influence there?
I don't think so, but you never know. Everyone's totally different, but I don't think so. I don't think you see anyone specifically going from players themselves.
You know, if you're a public figure, you influence people in the bad way, in the good way. You get influenced by them.
Well, I'm assuming that the majority are going to be appalled if they see anything like that on the pitch. But then there's always going to be percentage that are like, you know, thanks for, you know, raising that I am a bigot and I want to be able to voice my bigotry. So, yeah.
I think in certain way, yeah, it could influence a lot. Because, I mean, it depends of your mentality also, you know, like of your backgrounds.
There's still a lot of people out there that have their own views and try to put their views onto other people.
It affects people in different ways.
Why is that? Because there's a certain, I'd say, middle class, establishment, whatever. There's this thinking that's that English exceptionalism. Get over it, guys, you know?
Sometimes it makes potential immigrants to feel unsafe to come to this country. And at the same time, it makes many of us too, who have more things to contribute to the society, to reserve some and say, no, I better go and contribute this thing in another country where I feel I'll be safer and I will not experience such kind of racism that is obtainable here.
The racism on the pitch, if it's not addressed, I mean, it's legitimized, you know.
We asked the public to comment on their view about what racist abuse in sport tells us about the state of racism in Britain.
I'd say that in sports, kind of like the true nature is brought out when you're kind of cheering for your fans, cheering for your team, and it can get a bit crazy. I think that if there is racism there, it does show a lot about kind of what's in the true nature of British people, and it's quite sad to see that as well.
There's clearly like a plague, a virus of racism that still, you know, is deep embedded in the system, and it shouldn't be there. It should be out, you know, something that players shouldn't have to worry about, and not something they have to, you know, worry about when they come to do the thing they love doing.
Well, I think it's a reflection of where we are as a society in some respects. I don't think it's any better or any worse, actually. I mean, I think, I was just reading this morning that the incidence of stop and search of black people in London has gone up by 24%.
It's not nice, it shouldn't be happening, and the fact that it keeps popping up is disgraceful.
Well, it doesn't say anything nice, but it's not like other countries don't have it. Like, it's not a British problem. It's a problem that every nation has, whether it's in sport or, I don't know, the show business, anything public.
No, it's the same all across the world, I think. Don't matter just this country. It might be more publicised in this country, but it happens all over the world.
They always try to harm me, and that's, I think, is another face of like London or like UK, because yeah, it have all this stuff that you're saying, but I also experience like the way that people help me a lot, and people has been being so helpful.
Well, Britain knows is there, is the head, and people are looking over, you know, up to them for good behavior and really giving people the satisfaction they want and tackling things like racism as it should be. So they should do better than this.
So what does racism in sport say about racism in Britain on the international stage?
Well, it's worrying, isn't it? It is worrying.
It gives a very negative reputation about the British society. The British society is a good place, it's a nice place to stay, to live, an organized society. But I think there are a few members of the society here who are practicing such racism that seems to be done by majority of the society of Britain, which is not the majority that practice that racism. It's just a few of them, but it's just that the few people that practice the racism here, they are dominant. That is the thing.
I think Britain is not as racist as other places. However, is it perfect? No. So it is a landmark, but it's got some stains on it, so it can be cleaned.
You know, the UK is part of the United Nations Security Council, and we've seen how they have undermined other countries at the international level, you know, with their culture, the capitalistic, vicious capitalistic domineering culture, and it just transpires at the local level.
Yeah, I think the world is watching. The world is watching to make sure that we change our processes, and it's within cricket today, the meeting of every county board, all aspects of cricket has come to a conclusion that things need to change and things need to, and we need to engage with people. We need to actually engage and say, how can we make this right?
The evidence given by cricketer Azeem Rafiq confirms what many cricket players, footballers and other sports people have known for years. Racial abuse in Britain is widespread and committed by both players and fans. Many have their own stories of abuse to tell and can confirm that racist behaviour is frequently dismissed as a joke or not taken seriously by the organising, governing bodies of the sports.
These damaging revelations of a culture of racism in cricket, football and beyond suggest a deeply established presence of religious and ethnic abuse in British sport. And despite words of outrage from sports bodies and politicians, it still continues after all these years. Either because, at least until now, the sporting world couldn't put a stop to it, or because, quite simply, it hasn't cared enough to really try.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.